Welcome to Metro Connection. I'm Rebecca Shear. The holiday season is, of course, full of all sorts of traditions, some sacred and spiritual, others of a more secular and or shop-till-you-drop nature. Well, on this week's show, we're exploring all sorts of traditions with a focus on some specifically Washingtonian rituals. We'll visit a park site sacred to Native Americans with deep origins in the region and talk with a local woman who's hoping to give the site new prominence. We'll swing by a Prince George's County church that's taking the concept of a Christmas pageant to a whole new level. And we'll go inside a weekly event known as the Captain's Coffee and hear how it's bringing together houseboat residents on the D.C. waterfront. But first, we wanted to hear how you mark this festive and frenzied time of year. So we sent Metro Connection's Heather Taylor out on the streets to talk with Washingtonians about their own holiday traditions.
We're a Coast Guard family, so we travel around a lot. When I grew up, I mean, we were always with extended family and that kind of thing. But now we usually make homemade pizza on Christmas Eve, and then on Christmas Day, it's just a quiet day with my husband, my son, and I.
I'm from New Orleans. Back home, we always pick a color. And then we'll dress those colors on Christmas Day, and all our decorations will be those colors. Last year, colors were blue, teal, and silver. I honestly think it might have been like 10 years ago that we did red and green, but this year is red and gold, so I have to go find a Christmas outfit.
I like to do Christmas shopping kind of early. I like Black Friday. So I take advantage, even though I'm homeless, but I'm still part of the community. So what I do, I just save up for the whole month of November. And then when Black Friday comes, I take my children out shopping. And so around Christmas time, instead of being out in rushing, I can spend more time with my family. And it's fun.
Those were local residents speaking with Metro Connection's Heather Taylor in D.C. and Bethesda. So we just heard some of the present-day traditions of people in the Washington region. The traditions we'll hear about next come from people who date back centuries, millennia even. All around the Chesapeake Bay and along the Susquehanna and Potomac rivers.
So the site where I'm taking you is a very significant place.
We're on the banks of the Ladder River now in Accokeek, Maryland, with Gabrielle Tayek.
I'm a historian at the National Museum of the American Indian, and I'm a member of the Piscataway Indian Nation.
A Native American tribe that historically was one of the region's most populous and powerful.
The name Piscataway, did the people take their name from the land, or did the name of the land come from the people?
The people are so highly identified with their place that they take the name from the place. And Piscataway means where the waters blend.
We're above the waters now, on a boardwalk in Piscataway Park. And as you stroll over wetlands teeming with wildlife...
There's a bald eagle flying right there. You guys see it?
Yeah.
As in most parks, you'll see all sorts of signage about the animals, the plants, the recent project to restore the shoreline.
But there's very little about what the Native American history is, and this is really one of the most important sites on the East Coast and is in continuous practice as a pilgrimage site.
But Tayek is among those fighting to change that, because this place...
It's called the Accokeek Creek Site, or Moyone.
...was the Piscataway's central chiefdom at the time of European contact. Though Gabrielle Tayek, whose uncle is the Piscataway Indian Nation's present hereditary chief, says the settlement predated that contact.
The place has been occupied for at least 11,000 years.
By quite a bit.
That's how far the archaeology goes back.
Nowadays, all you see here, basically, is a big field with a sweat lodge.
You can see it's made out of saplings and heavy blankets.
But back then?
It would have been a stockaded village. People living in this guy, we called them witch huts, that were covered in reeds that with the domed roofs, and large extended families lived together in a matrilineal way.
They also lived very seasonally, and this connection to the land, to the earth, is reflected in their seasonal ceremonies, all of which involve that sweat lodge, by the way. There's the midwinter ceremony in February.
A long time ago, they would be in hunting camps, and so then they would want to come back together.
The awakening of Mother Earth in April.
Which talks about us fulfilling our original instructions to be stewards and caretakers of the earth, so Mother Earth will fulfill her responsibilities and bring things back.
Then the autumnal green corn ceremony.
And that gives thanks for all of the harvest and the corn coming in.
And November's Feast for the Dead.
To remember our ancestors and let things go back into rest.
Speaking of ancestors, Moyone wasn't just the Piscataway's principal village. It also was a burial ground.
They're what they call ossuary burials that are hundreds to over 1,000 years old all throughout the landscape. But because they've been there for so long, you won't see them. They don't look like cemeteries.
Although one burial site.
I'd like to take you over to the grave site.
Sure. So let's take a walk over there.
You will see. It's next to the sweat lodge and marked by a tree.
So this red cedar tree we call the Tree of Life.
Planted by Gabriel Tayac's grandfather, Turkey Tayac, a Piscataway leader, activist, and herb doctor.
Turkey Tayac planted this tree in 1976 on top of an ancient ossuary where there are hundreds of people buried below us from ancestral times.
And Turkey Tayac is actually buried there too, making him the only Native American buried in a national park after its creation. But that burial didn't come easy. See, in the 1960s, Turkey supported the creation of Piscataway Park on one condition.
That he could be buried here and that his people could always come here freely for cultural and spiritual purposes.
He and the Secretary of the Interior shook on it, and in the 1970s, as Turkey grew ill and sensed the end drawing near, he went back to the Interior Department, but they had no record of the agreement.
And he was really shocked because he was born in 1895, so he thought making a verbal agreement and shaking on it was enough, but they never signed anything.
So Turkey began lobbying for his own burial at Moyone. When he died in 1978, his children and grandchildren took on his cause.
And we were told that we would have to get an act of Congress passed in order to have him buried in a national park.
They put Turkey's body in a mausoleum, but they didn't back down. Letters of support came pouring in.
And finally, the act was passed in 1979, a year later, and he was buried here.
Of course, what happened at that burial is another story. One Gabriel Tayac, who was 12 at the time, remembers well. It was a chilly gray November day, she says. Sleet was streaming from the sky. And when the funeral procession reached the gravel road that leads to the Park Service and the landowners up the road refused to let the hearse go by.
And we had an act of Congress, but there was so much racial animosity down here during that time period. Things have changed, you know, things are better, but they did not want to comply.
So Turkey's family and friends did the only thing they could.
They had to hand carry the casket from all the way up the road.
And since then, at every Feast of the Dead, that procession is recreated. A burial shroud is carried down the road to the tree where people hang little red bundles of tobacco on the branches, each bundle representing a loved one who's died.
And when the wind blows, it carries the prayers up to the spirit world to intercede for you. So it's like a place where life and death converge, and it's not sad or creepy, you know. It's really more about making a connection back.
Back to the earth, to your ancestors, to your roots. And Gabriel Tayac says she's proud of her Piscataway roots, even if after years of disease, colonization, war, and assimilation, the tribe's numbers aren't what they used to be. The Piscataway also aren't recognized by state or federal government, though Tayac is among those fighting for recognition. As for Moyone one day achieving more recognition, Tayac says she feels more and more people are coming to understand the true meaning of the place.
You're not just walking on a field, and it's not just a stand of trees. This is so rich with life and ancestral deep time the way you might find in the caves in France. And it's just a matter of changing your perspective and start to open your eyes to a different way of seeing what's already here.
To see pictures of Moyone and to learn more about the Piscataway Indian Nation, visit our website, metroconnection.org. This next story is also about a community trying to hold on to its traditions. In this case, it's a group of Washingtonians living on the Southwest waterfront. And it's here in this watery alcove that a rather distinctive ritual was born years and years ago. But as Mark Adams reports, things may not be the same much longer.
It's 9 o'clock on a crisp Sunday morning, and Roger Thiel pulls his cart of coffee supplies down the dock toward his neighbor Debbie's house, boat.
So Sunday morning here, the idea is that we're going to have the coffee up and brewing for people by 9:30. So, and they show up sometimes at 9:30, but more often like 10.
Thiel organizes this weekly gathering in the houseboat community of Southwest D.C. It's called Captain's Coffee, and it's a tradition that goes back more than a decade here at the Gangplank Marina.
Well, Captain's Coffee just means that we get together socially on Sunday morning to enjoy the waterfront and each other's company and get up to date in a very informal situation.
But change is in the air, or perhaps in this case, on the water.
Everything you see on your right is going to be physically taken down.
He points to a small hotel near the water's edge.
Replaced by entirely new things similar to, well, this is an oversimplification, but similar to the Baltimore Harbor, the way that's been renovated.
Yeah. Hey, Ken, how's it going, man?
Good, yeah,
sorry. I'm doing Captain's Coffee at Debbie's. We're going indoors now.
Okay.
All right.
Thiel has been living on a boat here at the marina for 22 years. He's part of a community of 94 liveaboards, as they call themselves. And like his neighbors, Thiel accepts whatever may come down the river in stride.
I would say that like our kind of shaggy way of doing Captain's Coffee, though, we are savoring this old way while we still can.
The smell of coffee and pastries fills the air in this small houseboat as more people enter, each bringing a culinary delight to add to the sugary assortment already on the table.
This is blini.
Blini, yes, exactly. It's Russian blini.
Can they be warmed up?
No,
are they okay?
Is it warm? I don't know. I was trying to keep them warm.
It doesn't take long before the small kitchen and adjoining living room below are packed with boat dwellers of a variety of ages and backgrounds. For Eve Bratman, the gathering is just as practical as it is social.
It was the best way to meet the neighbors and to get all the boat tips that I needed. I live on an old houseboat that needs a lot of work, and so Captain's Coffee is always a great source of knowledge as well as camaraderie.
In fact, it's precisely this sense of community that led them all to trade in a life on land for a life literally spent rocking back and forth. Jason Kopp, a resident in his early 30s, decided to move here 4 years ago after just one visit.
So you were sold from day one?
From day one, yeah. I didn't know exactly when I would make it happen. I was like, I don't know if I'll be able to get this boat or how I'll get a loan or, you know, how it'll all happen. But it worked out, and, you know, like a month and a half later, after I think frightened my entire family because they were telling me, you're going to move onto a boat?
But things have already changed since Jason took that plunge. The marina has placed a cap on the number of dock spaces or slips that are granted liveaboard status, and each resident must renew his or her status as a liveaboard on a yearly basis. This means there is no permanent legal protection to ensure this community will be able to stay. Now, COP has been in regular talks with the developers who, with the blessing of the city, want to turn this quiet marina into a bustling tourist destination. He says construction is slated to start in about a year.
Right now, there's not a whole lot going on in terms of us having to move to new spaces, but during the transition period, we have a lot of good faith that they'll work with us to make the process as easy as possible. You know, we'll be willing to compromise as long as we can make sure that we can stay here and we can find a way to make the community enjoyable for people.
Resident Mikhail Schlossman is confident the community will survive.
Of course, change is going to bring change. I mean, we don't know what's going to happen in terms of that regard. But I think that we have such great people and such a good team of folks that people seem to be looking out for each other so that we don't think of the change as being a problem. We think of something that we can thrive with.
The residents raise their glasses.
Cheers.
Budimo.
Budimo.
It means let us be.
Let us be.
Budimo.
No matter the language, most residents here agree change is inevitable. But every Sunday, their Captain's Coffee tradition provides a jolt of hope that this liveaboard community will be united in facing whatever comes over the horizon. I'm Mark Adams.
You can find photos of the Captain's Coffee festivities on our website, metroconnection.org. And if your community has a tradition that goes way back, we want to hear about it. Send an email to metro@wamu.org or find us on Facebook at facebook.com/metroconnection.org. Time now for a quick break, but when we get back, making a buck when you live year-round at the beach.
people work two jobs. Some people even work three, just to make the same kind of salaries that they might make in a metropolitan area.
And the story of a local band that became famous almost by accident.
This was going to be our weekly card game. We'd find a little club to play in, make a few bucks, and just have a good time.
That and more coming your way on Metro Connection here on WAMU 88.5. I'm Rebecca Shear, and welcome back to Metro Connection. Today, we're bringing you our annual Traditions show. And coming up, we'll go inside a local musical tradition and meet the band that helped create Washington's acclaimed bluegrass scene. And we'll go behind the scenes at the big Broadway-style Christmas bonanza put on by a local church. But first, a different sort of tradition, one that's more about survival and paying the bills. Living at the beach may seem like a great idea when it's July and you're lounging on the sand with your family and friends. But what does living at the beach mean when it's January and jobs are scarce? Well, that's the topic of today's On the Coast. Our regular segment where coastal reporter Brian Russo brings us the latest on life on the eastern shore of Maryland and in coastal Delaware. And Brian joins us now from Berlin, Maryland. Hey there, Brian.
Hey, Rebecca. How are you?
Hey, good, good. So it's December now, and I'm going to venture a guess and say that Ocean City in December doesn't look very much like Ocean City in, say, August. Can you describe what it's like being there right now?
It's not exactly a ghost town, but it's pretty quiet. You can drive for probably a dozen blocks in Ocean City without seeing a store or a restaurant that's open. And even some of the most prominent businesses, such as the massive entertainment complex Secrets, are closed several days a week.
Okay, well, that's quite the big change. I'm guessing then there's a real trickle-down effect going on. Fewer jobs in retail and fewer jobs for restaurant workers then, right?
Exactly. A lot of people here work 6 or 7 days a week during the summer and then spend the winter months on unemployment, searching for work. I talked about this with Dave Lederman. He's a real estate agent, and he's also spent years moonlighting in the restaurant industry.
It's not that people aren't willing to work. The problem is they can't find jobs.
Right, absolutely.
You know, and even if they're lucky enough to find a job, maybe they actually make a little bit more off unemployment than they would at a seasonal job, an off-season job somewhere.
Okay, so say you patch together the money you make over the summer with unemployment or whatever money you manage to scrounge up during the winter. I have to ask, is that actually going to be enough to live on?
Well, if you look at the latest census figures, the median income in the counties here on the coast is somewhere between $47,000 and $50,000 a year. But what those figures don't tell you is how much those people in certain parts of the economy are affected by both the national economic downturn and the seasonal slowdown here. Darren Eng is a musician. He also owns a music shop in West Ocean City. He says the past few years have not been easy.
The amount of sales has definitely dropped over the years, but I've been lucky enough to diversify what I do at the store and kind of make it up in other areas. But as far as playing music, I've been lucky enough to keep it going. But it's getting tough, that's for sure.
Brian, I feel like you need to offer us at least a sliver of hope here. Is there any kind of bright side we can look to?
Well, there are some industries that are doing well. Healthcare is really booming because of the growing number of people that are retiring here on the coast. And there's a lot of talk about alternative energy being a source of jobs here in the future. Trevor Jones is with Warwick Community College in Salisbury. He's dean of occupational education. So he's in charge of all the programs designed to put students directly into the workforce.
We are seeing some of the development of the green requirements materializing on the shore. Obviously, still in this economic climate, it's still very, very limited. But again, as a community college that looks at those futures, we have already started developing some of those programs. We have an environmental energy technology program, for example.
But, you know, when you get right down to it, the beach is always going to be one of our most important assets. Memo Dieriker is with the Purdue School of Business at Salisbury University, and he says tourism provides a lot more jobs than people realize.
More important than the tourism industry, the allied industry that supports tourism, the HVAC contractors, the painters, the plumbers, the electricians who come and fix the hotel rooms and upgrade the hotel rooms and the condos, etc., that allied industry is going to continue to thrive because you and I might be painting our houses once every 15, 20 years. A hotel room has to be painted every 2-3 years.
That's right.
That is not going away.
And I'm guessing at least some of those hotels are open now, just in case anyone wants to ring in the new year at the beach.
Oh, yeah. I think most people down here on the coast would encourage everyone and anyone in Washington to come on down to the beach and ring in 2012 beach style.
Well, Brian, thanks so much for joining us, and happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you, too. It was always my pleasure.
Brian Russo is the coastal reporter for WAMU and the host of Coastal Connection on 88.3 in Ocean City, Maryland. If your job is driven by the seasons, we want to hear how you make it through the slow months. Send us an email at metro@wamu.org. Return now to Washington for a story about a bunch of working guys who made it very big as musicians right here in the nation's capital. Jared Walker gives us an inside peek at a band that transformed the local bluegrass scene and helped establish a now thriving musical tradition in D.C.
In 1971, a doctor, an artist, an instrument repairman, a cartographer, and a mathematician formed a bluegrass band. No, this isn't the beginning of a bad joke. It's the story of the Seldom Seen, a group considered by many to be the quintessential Washington, D.C. bluegrass band.
Well, come and listen to my story, the story that I know is true.
The five men, John Duffy, Ben Eldridge, John Starling, Mike Aldridge, and Tom Gray, were all accomplished musicians, but each member had a day job, and most were wary of the travel associated with being a musician. So they agreed to play sparingly, and mostly locally. Because of their few appearances, they settled on the name The Seldom Seen, and began playing Washington-area clubs without much fanfare. But as mandolin player John Duffy explained in a 1982 interview, that didn't last for long.
This was going to be our weekly card game. We'd find a little club to play in, make a few bucks, and just have a good time. Well, we were sitting around having a good time, minding our own business, and got famous.
Duffy and the Seldom Seen's take on bluegrass music drew heavily from predecessors in the Washington, D.C. bluegrass community, such as the Country Gentleman and Buzz Busby. But it also stressed the incorporation of songs from folk, pop, jazz, and rock and roll, and was defined by clear and strong vocals and contemporary instrumental breaks that weren't common at the time. Dudley Cannell, the current lead singer and guitarist for the Seldom Seen, says there's another way that the band diverges from traditional bluegrass.
John Duffy told me one time that, you know, he wasn't born in a log cabin, and he wasn't brought up in the coal mines. And so, you know, he had sort of a different take on bluegrass in general. I mean, John loved and adored traditional bluegrass, but he also knew that the music needed to grow, and he was the guy to do it. I think outside of Bill Monroe, John Duffy's probably the most important single figure in bluegrass.
Tom Gray is a bassist and founding member of the band.
Before we started playing it that way, bluegrass really had a hayseed country kind of image. We made it acceptable for city people to listen to this kind of music.
But Dick Spotswood, music historian and host of the Dick Spotswood Show on WAMU's Bluegrass Country, says this new sound wasn't introduced without controversy.
The southern rural people from whose lives that music grew out of were a little unhappy to see the city kids taking it and sort of running away with it and everything, but it's how art evolves as it passes from one place to another. The standards change, the traditions evolve, and the music becomes something other than what it started out to be. And bluegrass is like anything else. It either evolves or it dies.
The Seldom Seen evolved too. In 1996, John Duffy died suddenly of a heart attack. Without Duffy at the helm, Dudley Cannell and his bandmates almost gave up.
That was just a horrible, horrible time. He was just gone, and we assumed that the band was gone too. And we were really in mourning and grieving the loss of not only John but the music too, because we had a great time together. It was like a family.
But the group pressed on with a new lineup and continues to play in the Washington, D.C. area and across the nation. In November, the Seldom Seen celebrated its 40th anniversary with a sold-out concert at the Birchmere in Alexandria. The show featured performances from members both past and present, and an outpouring of support from both the local and national music communities. A fitting tribute to a band that helped put the spotlight on Washington's own version of an American musical tradition.
The Seldom Seen really is a product of the Washington area's bluegrass community. It does not sound like Nashville bluegrass music. It doesn't sound like Appalachian bluegrass music from Southwest Virginia. Washington bluegrass has its own sound.
A sound that moved a tradition forward. I'm Jared Walker.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, the Seldom Seen.
For more on the Seldom Seen, visit our website, metroconnection.org. Now, our weekly trip around the region. On today's Door to Door, we visit Northwest D.C.'s West End and LaDroit Park neighborhoods.
My name is Sonia Harrison. I live in LaDroit Park. LaDroit Park is a historic district right off of Florida Avenue and Rhode Island Avenue, very close to the U Street corridor. As a native Washingtonian, I went to Dunbar High School, and we actually did a walking tour of LaDroit Park, so I became familiar with it many years ago. And I remember a girlfriend and I walking through this neighborhood while we were in college, just admiring the architecture. We have some great murals. One is on a house that actually buttresses the park, so you have this beautiful mural there. That's the one that stands out the most for me, and it's representative of this community. You see in the mural the entrance to LaDroit Park, which is right at 6th and T. It's this beautiful iron gate that welcomes you into the neighborhood. That's in that mural, and we actually have some members of our community. As a matter of fact, one of our elders is in that mural, so it's a great representation of some of the spectrum of the diversity that's here.
My name is Linda Fries, and I live in West End, Washington. West End is bounded by Rock Creek Park to the west and lodged essentially between DuPont Circle and Washington Circle. It is named West End because this was the westernmost part of the city in the original L'Enfant plan before the incorporation of Georgetown into city boundaries. Urban renewal came to West End in the 1970s, but prior to that, the area was described as a dreary and decayed neighborhood, home to garages, a car dealership, printing plant, a laundry, an abandoned seal test dairy, and the last row houses at low rents within walking distance of the new downtown. Basically, no one lived here. All those businesses that were here, no residential. West End has been in a state of ripping everything down, and when it was those old businesses, that was a good thing. So we've maintained actually only, I would say, 30 of the old-time row houses, and they've all been redone, and they're all very nice. They really are. I fall out the front door and I'm at the drugstore or a cafe. We're actually quite close to Massachusetts Avenue here. If you go straight up 23rd Street, it's N-O-P, and then there's the P Street Bridge into Georgetown. And then one more block and you're at Massachusetts Avenue. Everything is very close. If there were anything, I would like a few less condominiums. But we're in the heart of the city. That's going to happen. So the good and the bad with living downtown.
We heard from Linda Fries in the West End and Sonia Harrison in LaDroit Park. Your community can be a part of Door to Door, too. Just send an email to metro@wamu.org or visit us on Facebook. That's facebook.com/metroconnection.org. And to surf around an interactive map of all the doors we've knocked on so far, visit our website, metroconnection.org. After the break, transforming Frank Capra's holiday classic, It's a Wonderful Life, into a one-man show.
It has the characters from, it tells the story of, but we're not recreating Capra. We're really creating our own iteration of this story.
And going behind the scenes at a Christmas pageant like no other.
You got the donkeys, you got the sheep, you got the horse.
This is like a whole barnyard.
Yeah.
It's just ahead on Metro Connection here on WAMU 88.5. Welcome back to Metro Connection. I'm Rebecca Shear, and during this most wonderful time of the year, if you happen to turn off your radio and turn on your TV, chances are at some point you'll find at least one channel playing this.
Mary, I know what I'm going to do tomorrow and the next day and next year and the year after that. I'm shaking the dust of this crummy little town off my feet and I'm going to see the world.
Or this.
Look, Daddy, teacher says every time a bell rings, an angel gets his wings.
That's right. That's right. Attaboy, Clarence.
It's Frank Capra's 1946 film, It's a Wonderful Life, an initial box office flop that's become a holiday staple around the world. The movie, of course, stars Jimmy Stewart as George Bailey, a man who sacrifices just about everything for his family and community, only to have his whole life fall apart on Christmas Eve. When George considers suicide, his guardian angel, Clarence, steps in and shows George how life would be had he never been born. For us here in the D.C. region, our television sets aren't the only place we can watch the story of George Bailey unfold right about now. The Hub Theater in Fairfax, Virginia, is bringing George's tale to life on the stage in a world premiere one-man show titled Wonderful Life. Jason Lott plays about a dozen characters throughout the play, which he co-wrote with Hub's artistic director Helen Bafumi, who says her company is dedicated to producing work that celebrates what she calls our better human nature. I recently met up with Jason and Helen at the National Gallery of Art's Sculpture Garden Ice Rink, a rather festive place this holiday season, where Helen kicked things off by making a pretty big confession.
I'm not a fan of Christmas. I'd say I'm not a Grinch, but I think it can be a really stressful time of year, and I think it's a lot about the materialistic side of things. And as a mom, it bothers me. As a consumer, it bothers me. And so it's always rough for me to program at that time. I want to do something that's about the season, but to find work that doesn't make me gag is really, to put it gently, is very difficult for me. And so when I thought about what stories of the holidays that I would be excited about telling, I thought about Capra's It's a Wonderful Life and its enduring nature. And when I really re-looked at the story, I realized, first of all, it's not a story that's about Christmas until the very end. But there's a million play versions of this movie, but I just didn't like it. And I had this idea, I'm like, I would love to do a one-man show of this. Would that be possible? And as soon as I thought about doing a one-man show, I immediately was like, and Jason Lott should do it.
So when she approached you, your reaction was?
Well, of course, immediately flattered and immediately interested as well. One of the things about it, though, is as soon as Helen asked me about it and she said that she'd be writing it, I asked if it would be possible if I could help out with her writing. I haven't done a whole lot of writing, but because I was going to be so intimately involved with the story and the performance of the story, I wanted to sort of be in on the ground floor as well. And Helen was kind enough to allow me to co-adapt with her.
What are your feelings toward the movie?
It's interesting because I had actually never seen the complete movie before.
You're kidding.
Never.
Seriously?
Seriously. Never seen the complete movie before Helen asked me to do it. And so I immediately went out and got a copy and watched it and immediately fell in love with it. It's such a beautiful and amazing story of one man figuring out how connected he is to the rest of the world, to his family and friends, and what happens when he's not there and what a detrimental effect that can have. And I think that's one of the great things about the story is it's telling people, hey, pay attention to, you know, to your family, your friends, and your community, and be there, be present in their lives.
That kind of reminds me of what Helen was saying about the overall mission of Hub, sort of about people's better natures. Do you see a connection there?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I know that many people, they'll write their mission in a broad way so that they can say, oh, yeah, everything fits under that umbrella. Or they'll make some really tangential, you know, have to make six leaps to justify the play being in their repertoire. But it's actually the first question I ask myself when I look at producing a play. Wonderful Life is the perfect example of being a community. You feel it in the script.
Can we talk about the script and the adaptation process? How you even started, like, dissecting this movie and turning it into a one-person thing?
I think we really started off just trying to condense the actual screenplay, which we realized
It's kind of an impossible task. I mean, it's such a, I mean, like the movie itself runs 2:15, something like that. And to do a one-man show that is essentially the movie over and over again, you know, and to have that run for 2 hours and 50 minutes is kind of a really tough task.
It's also interesting when you get down to the play that we've written, we really had to kill off a lot of the characters of Bedford Falls. We did. We had to be like, nope, you're no longer integral to this story. We had to. Yeah, it just, there was no room for them in it.
We tried very hard to get as many of them in as we could. Right. I mean, you know, Annie, who's one of the great characters, you know what I mean? But she's not going to make an appearance in our play.
Annie. Yeah.
What about Bert and Ernie, the cop and the cabbie?
Bert and Ernie are both in.
Oh, good.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it wouldn't be Bedford Falls without Bert and Ernie. They play such a huge role in the town itself, and they're buddies of George, so they are still in.
Have you done a one-man show before?
I have. It can be a haul, certainly, because, you know, you're talking for at least an hour, sometimes over. And it's just you. And this one is also a direct address piece. So you're talking right at the audience members. So if they get tired of you, you can see it pretty quickly. You can tell when they're falling asleep in the front row.
Never going to happen.
Hopefully not. But, I mean, it's really an interesting relationship that you establish with the people that you're talking to. And you're involving them in the story. And to see their involvement is really a fulfilling thing when they're with you. And then they're surprised by what your character says and does. I mean, it's really a rewarding type of things.
Of course, in this one, everyone pretty much knows the story. So in terms of those surprises, do you think there can still be surprises for the audience?
I think there will be some. I mean, first of all, I'm assuming there's probably maybe 2% of the population who, like me, had never seen the movie. So they might be coming to this and not know anything about the story. And we're hoping that when those people see this, they won't feel like they've missed out because they don't know the movie, but they've still gotten the story of George Bailey. But I think that people will be a little bit surprised. Sure, they may know the plot lines, but we're not doing impersonations. You know what I mean? So you're not gonna hear me talking like Jimmy Stewart for 2 hours and 15 minutes, see? So I think there might be some surprises in the way that perhaps some of the characters are portrayed, and perhaps even some of the iconic lines will sound a little different, you know, because it's coming from a different version of the character. And I guess I would say, for those people who haven't seen the movie, come and check it out, because I think you'll enjoy the story of Wonderful Life. But I think if you're a fan of the movie, you're going to be a fan of the play as well. Because when you get down to the bare bones of the story, it is the same. And it's all about us learning about what a wonderful life we have.
That was Jason Lott and Helen Pifumi talking about Wonderful Life, Hub Theater's new one-man show running through December 27th. For ticket information and to see photos from the production, visit our website, metroconnection.org. While we're on the subject of holiday classics, trimming a Christmas tree is a holiday standby that dates back at least 500 years. But like most traditions, Christmas trees have changed a fair bit over the years. Sabri Benachour gets back to holiday basics in a way, with an organic farmer who's taking a different approach to this most iconic of seasonal emblems.
At a small but bustling organic farmers market in Columbia Heights, I met up with Mike Tabor. He's a sustainable farmer who splits his time between his home in Silver Spring, Maryland, and his farm in Pennsylvania.
It smells great here. What are you selling?
We're selling a number of varieties of apples, apple pear cider. We did bring back some goodies from Amish neighbors, some pies, and of course Christmas trees and wreaths that we make.
Tabor grew up in a low-income housing project in Brooklyn, nowhere near a farm.
Yeah, I grew up in Fort Greene in Brooklyn, near the Navy Yard, where there are no trees.
He got a master's degree in anthropology and then came to D.C. in the 60s, looking for a job in the public schools.
And I remember the one of the assistant superintendents who interviewed me here in Washington, where would I like to teach? And I said, well, Anacostia or Northeast. And they said, Mr. Tabor, you've almost got a Ph.D. You have got to teach in Upper Northwest, period. And we're talking 1965. And I said, you know, I'm not sure if education, the field is open for me, which is what, again, led me in, once again, a different direction.
a different direction that eventually led to farming. He's been at this now for 32 years, 6 days a week, getting up at 4 a.m. Christmas trees are one of his most important crops.
I mean, you have to understand, it's not a hobby. It's a way of extending our farm season so that we could pay people till the end of the season.
And his Christmas trees, they're not your typical trees.
Let's go walk over.
Sure.
They're not perfect.
This tree would not be acceptable commercially. In fact, when I brought it to be baled, the guy said, well, why didn't you paint it? Meaning, why didn't you dye it?
You heard right. Tabor says most trees are painted. The National Christmas Tree Association says this isn't done to artificially color Christmas trees. The group says it's really just sunscreen to keep the needles from naturally bleaching during the late summer. But either way, Tabor doesn't like it.
So these trees are somewhat different colors, somewhat rustic, less pruned than a lot of trees would be, a little bit more forest-like, but still, they're nice trees.
Tabor says the typical perfectly pruned tree is forcing life to imitate plastic, which is not what he is about.
You know, we have this little label, sustainably raised trees. But,
and what does that mean?
It means we take extra care, no herbicides, there's no pesticides on the trees that are petroleum-derived. There's no artificial color, and we really encourage people to replant little seedlings.
Is there any certain amount of irony that a Jewish kid from Brooklyn ended up growing Christmas trees?
Oh, I'm sure there is. We did put one daughter through Jewish day school from the Christmas tree money.
Tabor says these days he just about breaks even. He's kind of an iconoclast when it comes to making a profit. He makes a point of keeping his prices low.
It's a high, lofty ideal that keeps on coming back to haunt us when we're short of money. I remember once I got up at a conference of other sustainable growers, and a part of the talk I gave was that if all we're doing is raising food for the wealthy, although that's not unimportant, if we're not selling to all income groups, there's a question about our purpose and our work.
As Tabor speaks, he spots an old man pocket an organic brownie from his stand and hobble off.
If it helped that guy to take that dessert, that's fine.
It's entails some sacrifices to be sustainable, it sounds like.
Yeah. Like these trees, it would make a difference if we used herbicide, if we used Roundup. It would be a lot easier to grow.
Tabor says if he pushed his trees with fertilizer and pesticides, he could grow them in about 8 years. But he doesn't, so his trees take 20 years to grow. That extra time and effort, he says, is worth it.
My daughter gave me a sign where she quoted from the Talmud. She put it up in front of my desk. It says, I have not wasted my day. That message is very important to me. What have I done that's good? Who have I helped?
It's a message, Tabor says, that fits well with the Christmas season. I'm Sabri Benashour.
Rockin' around the Christmas tree at the Christmas party hop. Mistletoe hung where you can't see, every couple tries to stop. Rockin' around the Christmas tree, let the Christmas
end this week's traditions show at Evangel Cathedral in Upper Marlboro, Maryland. It's one of the region's largest black congregations, with 2,000 people attending services any given Sunday. And for the past 21 years, Evangel has produced an annual Christmas play. At first, it was pretty small scale with a cast of 20. These days, though, the cast numbers more than 200. Emily Friedman visited the final dress rehearsal at the congregation to find out what it takes to make such a massive show go on.
When I arrive at Evangel Cathedral, musicians are warming up, and the cast is standing in a circle, quietly holding hands. After 4 months of rehearsals, four times a week, it's just about showtime.
Amen? Amen. Can you do it?
Yes, we can!
Will you do it?
Yes, we will!
Are you sure?
Yes!
The director calls places, and 200 people scatter off. They're wearing costumes from all eras, from modern street clothes to Victorian long-sleeve dresses to biblical chic with robes and headscarves.
It has grown from a church putting on a local play to now a national, full-blown event.
This is Peyton Gray.
I'm one of the elders or associate pastors here at Evangel Cathedral, and I've been a member here for 26 years.
Performance art is a big part of what this church does, Gray explains. About half of the performers are church members, and the other half aren't. The play, he says, helps the church reach out to new potential members and reinforce bonds with current membership.
And what happens is you have parents who are in it, who got married and had kids, and their kids are now in it. And now their kids are talking about, when I get married, I want to have my kids to be in it. So it creates a continuum.
And since sharing the gospel is so central to their mission, church leaders are willing to put a lot of money behind it.
We're talking about a pretty substantial budget. It's in the high hundreds of thousands, I'll say it that way.
The biggest slice of the budget goes to pay 8 nationally known gospel singers, including several Grammy winners. 2 or 3 of the 8 sing in each performance alongside the local cast. Tickets for the show run as much as $85 a seat.
A lot of people say, well, you know, that's really a high ticket for a church play. Well, you have to remember, there's a segment in a community of people who want really good Christian entertainment.
Pastor Gray and I head back into the theater, which, for the record, holds 300 more people than the largest theater on Broadway. I take one of the expensive seats up front as the cast begins to tell what is, in all likelihood, the most popular story ever.
It was the most exciting time in all of history.
Joseph, we're gonna have a son. A son? Oh, Mary, this is so, so great. The things I could do with my son. Oh, I could teach him how to work with his hands. Oh, man, I could even teach him how to fish.
Within a moment after Mary reveals she's already pregnant, it's clear Joseph no longer thinks this is so, so great.
How can you do this to me?
Joseph pushes Mary away, and she begins to sing.
I'm waiting in a silent prayer. I am trying to live by the Lord I've been. In a world that's colder.
Evangel certainly tells a more dramatic storyline than the gospel, but there are other parts of the show that are quite realistic. For starters, the dozens of live animals in a tent outside, waiting for their cues.
Those are the camels that were in Scorpion King. It's 3 of them.
Whoa.
Yeah, see?
Hi.
Pastor Gray nuzzles up to a camel.
Yeah, hey. What's up? You good?
We walk all the way around the tent to meet the other stars.
You got the donkeys, you got the sheep, you got the horse.
This is like a whole barnyard.
Yeah.
As we make our way back inside, I bump into some of the show's youngest cast members. They tell me they plan on being in this show every year of their lives.
It was so fun. I just want to do it for Jesus and have fun.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how would you guys rate being in the play?
10.
10. 10.
1,000.
These girls, and all cast members, are required to be at all rehearsals, even if you're an infant.
My name is Antonio Pierce, and my son that's playing Baby Jesus, his name is Keontae Pierce. This is my fiance, Ebony Harrison.
The mother of Baby Jesus.
Keontae has been playing Baby Jesus 4 times a week for 4 months, nearly his whole life.
It's draining, but, you know, they need him.
With people coming from as far as Boston and Ohio to see the show, even Baby Jesus steps up his game. After all, this isn't your average church play. I'm Emily Friedman.
Final performances are this weekend, so if you'd like more information on the Evangel Cathedral Christmas celebration, now's the time to visit our website, yeah. metroconnection.org.
Spirit of Christmas is all over the place. Lordy, Lordy.
And that's Metro Connection for this week. We heard from WAMU's Sabri Benashour, Emily Friedman, Brian Russo, Heather Taylor, and Jared Walker, along with reporter Mark Adams. Jim Ascendio is our news director. Our managing producer is Tara Boyle. Jonna McCone, Lauren Landau, Peter Domingos, and Heather Taylor produce Door to Door. Thanks, as always, to the WAMU engineering and digital media teams for their help with production and the Metro Connection website. Our theme song, Every Little Bit Hurts, and our door-to-door theme, No Girl, are from the album Title Tracks by John Davis and used with permission of the Ernest Jennings Record Company. You can see a list of all the music we use on our website, metroconnection.org. And while you're there, you can find us on Twitter, you can like us on Facebook, you can listen to individual Metro Connection stories, and if you'd like to listen to the whole show, you can click the podcast link up at the top of the page. We hope you can join us next week when we pile our plate with some culinary classics. We'll chew on a bunch of our favorite food stories from the past year, on everything from kimchi to gourmet Pop-Tarts. And we'll meet the local chef who cooks with some of the world's most searingly hot peppers.
You know, we first starting off, you do your habanero and you're chopping these things and it's all great. And then all of a sudden you wipe your eye. You're like, what the heck? And that's when you start learning about peppers.
I'm Rebecca Shear, and thanks for listening to Metro Connection, a production of WAMU 88.5 News.